and on, I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on serious issues, issues in depth that the mainstream media simply does not discuss, or if they do it superficially and with bias. It is my contention that just like there is a small but important audience for good quality films and other forms of arts, there's also a larger group of people who would love to hear just good quality broadcasting. Today, we're going to give you that. We are continuing with our series of Remarkable Minds, Russia and U.S. Relations, Life in Russia and Its Future. My guest, Dmitriya Vorolov. Dmitriya is a Russian-American engineer, an author. He has a background on writing on economic, environmental, and political decline and collapse of the U.S. and modern industrial culture. He was an eyewitness to the collapse of the Soviet Union and has researched extensively its causes and the reasons for the failure of both the Soviets and Americans to predict and understand it accurately. Dmitriya is very popular among the peak oil community, such as Richard Heinberg, and frequently writes on the looming energy crisis. He's written 5 books, notably Reinventing Collapse. He has also written the 5 Stages of Collapse, and he's with us now. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be with you, Gary.
I believe that we do not have the patience nor the time, nor we do we make that time in the media to discuss something in depth. I've met so many producers who say that the average topic must be discussed in about 5 minutes, and that includes lead-ins, introductions, outs, and the host bantering back and forth. And indeed, when you watch Bill O'Reilly and many of the other panels, it's about 5 minutes. I don't know what a person could learn in that, and therefore we devote a full hour, and where I do mainly listening and use this more as a classroom on the air. I've selected the topic of Russia and the United States for a simple reason. There's a massive movement with the neocons, the pro-war people, to try to create another Cold War environment, in effect to try to scare Americans into overreacting and to believing that Russia is in some way militarily capable of launching an attack against the United States and destroying it. We have also simultaneously been doing the same with China. We have postured with the President of the United States, meeting with countries that surround China as if by putting some military facilities around China in Australia, New Zealand, in Cambodia, and Vietnam, that will tell the Chinese we mean business. The paradox is that China has been the economic savior of the United States over the last 12 years. We have borrowed enormous amounts, over $1.7 trillion from China alone, so that we could continue with our foolish wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, our military expeditions around the world. And we'll never pay that money back. We have missed an opportunity to educate the public about Russia and China, both of their strengths and weaknesses, what our relationship should be and ideally could be. And for those of us who would love to see the United States, China, and Russia to de-arm at a nuclear level, and these are the big three, we have made really no progress there. To the contrary, the average American is unaware that we spend over $7 billion a year maintaining and upgrading our nuclear stockpiles. We have enough nuclear bombs in the United States to kill every man, woman, and child on the earth 27 times over. And yet there's a whole industry that says we have to keep first strike capability. We have to, you know, create all this for deterrence. And so we don't know about Russia. We don't know what it's about. We are told on the one hand that you can't trust anything in Russia because it's all a giant fraud, that you have power held in the hands of relatively few people, oligarchs, and former government officials, as manifested in Putin, who is a multi-billionaire, we're told, that there's no real freedoms, and that You can't do anything without massive layers of corruption, and that for the majority of Russians, it is not a quality of life place to live. That's what we've been told. I'd like for you now to take your time and reveal the true Russia today and the fact that we could never win a war against Russia or China, and now they're both working together. So you could imagine that scenario. And why is the real, what is the real story that we are posturing? What do we fear? Because clearly it's based upon fear. And imagining the American public will never get smart enough to figure out how they've been played. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, I think that the thing that the United States should really fear the most is not any foreign country on earth. This country's greatest enemy is itself, its own various complexes, the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, the medical, the educational establishment. All of these are basically things that are predatory, that are eating this country up from the inside, that are enslaving its people and driving them further and further into debt for the sake of enriching the Washington regime and the oligarchs that it supports, to put it in Russian terms. And so this is all a way of distracting people from what is really going on by pointing across the border and pointing at countries that are opaque from an American point of view, where Americans can't understand or read the language, they don't really understand the culture very well. So it is very easy to project anything you want onto just basically what amounts to a blank screen, and to project onto these countries the things that Americans don't like and don't like to admit about themselves.
At present, there remains much worry, Dmitry, over a weakening dollar in the near future and a drop as the fiat global currency. And simultaneously, we're witnessing countries, notably the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, moving forward with trading resources and energy products in their national currencies. And when you were on the program last, we spoke a little bit about the new Cold War that is emerging between the U.S. and Russia, and we should include China as well. There are the strained relationships between the U.S. and Russia regarding the Middle East, such as Syria, Iran, and Israel, the expansion of NATO, access and export of oil and natural gas to strategic ports and pipelines across neighboring nations. So I'd like to hear your review and estimation of this new Cold War, and in particular, how much it relies upon energy exports, since this is one of Russia's primary sources of revenue, and Russia is getting rich and because of its oil and gas, and also because it's modernizing and creating alliances, as is China, and we're left out of that loop because we've taken a different position towards them. I'd like you to get into this, and behind all of it, I see ultimately what the likely outcome would be if China and Russia and the other nations, including the nations in South America, wake up one day and just say, we are no longer using the dollar, goodbye. Now, many of them are not using the dollar now, but when this becomes public and it shakes the stability of the dollar as a reserve currency, I believe that other nations that are relying upon the dollar as a reserve currency will panic and try to unload dollars. And you'll have the largest shift in currency values and trading in world history. I believe people will go toward safer resource havens, and the dollar will drop like a lead balloon, and that will throw us into a panic in the United States with massive hyperinflation and devaluation. I'd like for you to address all these, please.
Well, first of all, the fact that the dollar is really slowly but surely going away as the reserve currency of choice, that is something that has been in the works for a while. There are now bilateral agreements between all of the BRIC countries, and then more and more countries that trade with China are using the yuan. The Chinese are pursuing something that they call the doctrine of small steps, and they've been pursuing it for a long time. And the idea there is to reduce Chinese holdings of U.S. Treasury paper, reduce the role that the dollar plays in trade, in Chinese trade, and to replace it with the yuan. Recently, China has started stockpiling gold so as to be able to denominate its convertible currency in gold, to basically go on the gold standard. At the same time, the U.S. has absolutely emptied itself of gold by leasing it out, and the leased out gold gets melted down and resold, and will never come back. So the fact that, you know, the United States is in the process of losing its advantage of basically being able to print dollars and then demand that the world pay for these dollars in products and services, that is really not going to be with us for very much longer. And you're right that this usually ends in a rout. Most financial unravelings proceed slowly over time, and then when the outcome becomes absolutely inevitable and clear to all, there's a panic. And now that everything is networked and it takes milliseconds to perform a trade, it may actually unravel within a single afternoon, or maybe it'll be one of those flash crashes where markets close and then they remain closed for a while and there's some discussions, and then they reopen and there's another crash, and then they close and perhaps close for good. So we are really looking to a massive shift away from the U.S. dollar, and with it away from the United States being in a position to dictate terms to other countries. Now, a lot of countries, China and Russia in particular, are already not really willing to allow the United States to dictate terms. A particular point of disagreement is this tendency that the United States have to keep destroying countries. So it destroyed Iraq. Iraq used to be a very orderly, highly organized place under Saddam Hussein, and now it is absolutely chaotic and lethal. Then they knocked over Libya. Libya, again, was quite rich with a really good social safety net, free education, free, very good quality health care. They were putting up communication satellites serving the rest of Africa. They were doing, Gaddafi in particular, was a very respected statesman throughout Africa in the post-colonial space. But Americans, and with French and British help, destroyed Libya, and now Libya is chaotic and lethal. And now Syria, because the United States insisted that Bashar al-Assad should be overthrown, has been thrown into a state of civil war. There are hundreds of thousands of refugees in neighboring countries. The place is a disaster area. And so now it's going to proceed to other countries, perhaps Yemen. But China and Russia are no longer willing to go along with this American plan to keep destroying one country after another. And they have recently been using the veto in the UN Security Council to thwart American efforts to make it look like what they're doing is somehow legal. And that is probably going to be the pattern from now on. Basically, China and Russia and perhaps other countries will sign on to this program, will basically stop cooperating with the U.S. in its effort to destroy various countries.
Take us now to a timetable. If you can, I realize it's subjective, but based upon all the different factors that you see aligning, when do you start to see this unraveling happening?
Well, it's really happening as we speak. If you just spend a bit of time living in various places, I lived in the U.S. most of my life with many extended trips to Russia and various other places. Most recently, I spent last winter in Russia. I was there for a few months, just basically living I had a lot of paperwork issues to resolve for my family, and so I spent a lot of time dealing with bureaucrats, going to a lot of government offices, and, you know, riding public transportation, traveling around a little bit, talking to people, and living the normal life, you know, going shopping, having to deal with various other institutions there. And it is absolutely amazing what you see when you kind of see the trajectory of a place. Every time I go back to Russia, it gets better. Every time I go back to the United States, it gets worse. Now, it's sort of like boiling a frog. If you live in the same place all the time, then you don't really see these differences. You don't see things getting continuously better or getting continuously worse. But believe me, Russia is becoming a kind of a posh almost place, very polished. The people are very well dressed. There's a huge emphasis on everybody being, as Russians like to say, adequate. They're not really willing to deal with inadequacy in dress or in how people speak or in how people write. There's a level of refinement that's being very forcefully imposed on society. There's an elevation of standards that is going on. So you walk down a city street in St. Petersburg, and it, after the United States, it's absolutely amazing how well people are dressed. That is one of the things. And then if you buy a ticket to the theater, it's just amazing how well people are dressed there. And, of course, everybody has to be clean-shaven and have a fresh haircut and a clean shirt and all of those sorts of things. And then you go to the United States, and there are these basically zombie-like people running around, and they could be middle-aged, but they look like teenagers, and they dress like teenagers, and they talk like teenagers. And the impression that you get is that this is a country that is becoming impoverished. It is becoming rather threadbare in a lot of ways. It's becoming decrepit, and it's becoming vulgar and slovenly to an absolutely astounding extent. So if you look at that, you just basically see one country going one way, another country going another way, and there's no mistaking it. Now, how quickly these things run their course? Well, they generally take a few generations, and you don't notice what's being lost until you talk to some young people and compare to what, I don't know, what we were like when we were young. And again, differences are unmistakable. So it may take a decade for this to become completely obvious to most people. There will always be people to whom this never becomes obvious, but the trend is unmistakable.
Take us through what it's like to be a person, an average person in Russia. And you mentioned St. Petersburg. There are many major cities in Russia. So let's not just talk about those who are at the higher end of the economic scale, because I could also take you to Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, Sutton Place. I could take you to Tribeca and other places where the people are well-dressed. They're well-groomed. I could take you to Lincoln Center. You could see some Broadway areas. So I don't think it is a fair comparison until you start looking at the average person, middle-class people, and the poorer people, how they live, what is afforded them, what is not. So let's examine them, because then I'm sure that somewhere in Russia you're going to have a Detroit or a Compton or Camden, New Jersey, or Newark. There, you know, you would still have some poverty. But and the educational system in Russia compared to the educational system in the United States, the opportunities in Russia versus the opportunities in the United States, the freedoms in Russia versus the freedoms in the United States. Take us through each of these.
Well, to start at the bottom, there are Camden, New Jerseys, and there are Detroits in the former Soviet space. These are mostly single-factory Soviet towns that were built for a purpose. And the Russian government is trying to shut them down and resettle the people, to basically turn them into ghost towns. But those are the worst places to be. And a lot of the time, the people there are just basically too far gone. You know, the amount of despair and desolation that they had to deal with has undermined them to an extent that they really can't easily be resettled anywhere. Rampant alcoholism and things like that. There are rural areas where they were basically forced to grow stuff, even though not much of anything grows there. A lot of Russia has poor soil, really, just sandy and not very productive soil. But in the Soviet times, it was still used for agriculture, but now it's just the land is fallow, and the communities used to try to farm there. Again, there's a lot of devastation. But at the other extreme, there's Moscow, St. Petersburg, and a handful of other cities that are becoming ever more prosperous. So there's a building boom, there's a paving boom, the roads are getting better, a lot of new infrastructure is being put in. I went back there and was amazed because all of the regional trains, the electric trains, have been updated, all new stations, all new track. So there's continuous infrastructure improvement that's going on. And the wealth is spreading from the center to the periphery. There are a lot of people from St. Petersburg and Moscow who buy bits of land pretty far away from those cities, days of travel. They're basically spreading their wealth out through the countryside, and so the improvements just radiate out. And then more and more cities are becoming quite vibrant. A lot of cities, for instance, have in Russia a very vibrant theater, live theater scene. You can go buy a ticket to a live performance in a lot of these places, whereas in the U.S. there's, you know, the Cineplex, and that's about it. A lot of these towns are actually becoming very pleasant places to live as well. In terms of the reality for everyday people, well, the educational system used to be really, really good in the Soviet time. Everybody says that it has gotten better. There are a lot of these for-profit private teaching institutions, sort of American style, and a lot of people complain that they're just as bogus as the American ones, granting diplomas that are literally worthless. So there's quite a bit of that sort of rot. People think that it's kind of Western influence that produced that rot. But it's still a pretty good educational system in a lot of ways. You know, the students that graduate from Russian schools, a lot of them actually do know how to read and write their native language quite adequately and know quite a bit of other stuff too, including some science. Unemployment rate is extremely low by American standards. Here, the real unemployment rate is around 25% if you calculate it the way the Russians do, whereas in Russia, it's something like 5.4%. And it's going up a little bit, but not by much. So unemployment is at historically low levels, and salaries have literally doubled in the last 10 years or so, more than doubled. So people are becoming a lot wealthier. They're buying household appliances. They're buying cars. They're building houses. A lot of people have inherited apartments from the Soviet days and now own them free and clear. And these were in not so spectacular looking buildings on the outside. But if you walk into one of these apartments, it's all marble and polished wood and expensive paneling. And entertainment centers, all sorts of computer equipment. Russia is now, I think, ahead of most countries in the world in internet access. It's become extremely well connected to the internet just about everywhere. A lot of government services have moved to the internet so that the bureaucracy, which is still fearsome, is quite a bit easier to deal with because at least you can download these ridiculously huge forms that everybody has to fill out. So there's just constant improvement along those lines. The medical system is basically a for-profit model, but it's not extreme in the way the American system is, in the sense that it's, you know, the doctors, they charge, but they charge amounts that are not just ridiculously confiscatory. They don't bankrupt people. And then certain services are just completely free. So, for instance, if you have a child, the government actually takes care of you, takes care of the child and the mother, and you can pay extra for extra services. You can go to a higher quality maternity clinic if you pay some money. But again, we had a child while we were in Russia, and so I know this firsthand. And the entire process, just getting the best service available there, cost less out of pocket than just the ultrasound and other tests in the U.S. That should give you an idea of the price differential there. And in terms of access to medicine, There are no prescriptions. A prescription in Russia is the doctor tells you the name of the drug and the dosage and how often to take it. You write it down. You take that piece of paper to the pharmacy and tell the pharmacist. Now, you could also prescribe the stuff to yourself if you know what it is you need and just go and talk to the pharmacist directly. So there isn't this idea that you have to go and find a doctor and pay that doctor hundreds of dollars just to get a slip of paper to get the medicine that you need. That doesn't exist in Russia. So overall, it's just a much more humane system, it turns out, much more helpful in terms of allowing people to survive, whereas here the whole thing is really designed to make it as difficult as possible to survive. That's what it seems like to me.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union, over 140 million Russians were left in despair. After all, for over 70 years, they had had free everything, free education, free health care, free food, free rent. They were guaranteed a job. They were completely inefficient at just about everything they did. That was part of the corruption of the system and non-competitive. The life expectancy of the average Russian male dropped to 59, the lowest of any developed country. Then there began the quiet years, where the average American was unaware of any of the transitional points. Today, take us through the health care, the diet, the longevity factor, and what has replaced the hopelessness or the manipulation that was so common when people had worked in a factory, were given shares in the factory, only to have the factory not be able to operate unless it was taken over by some outside source that gave a tiny amount of money for the shares. And then the other people came in to own the factory, and then the people were left with virtually nothing. What has happened to all those people, their health, their longevity, their diet, children's health? Because I'd like to look at that as compared to what is happening in the United States to our senior citizens. I just finished filming Growing Old in America, a new documentary, plus Poverty Inc., a separate documentary. And sometimes the two conversations overlapped. I'd be talking with an older person who was also now, for the first time in their life, not gainfully employed, too young to collect Social Security, had no pension, and were living day to day under dire circumstances. As one woman said, the humiliation of her having to go to a food bank where she'd been a volunteer for 20 years, and now she was going to receive food. And there are at least 15 million senior citizens in the United States who are, if for all intents and purposes, at poverty's door. We're doing nothing for them. Zero. Zip. Not a single thing. Nothing at all. Not politically, not socially, nothing. They're just abandoned. It would remind me of something that happened to the Russian people when Larry Summers and other whizzy people came in and said, oh, we know what to do. We'll help you. And all they had in mind was exploiting the crisis to their advantage. So take us through this, please.
Well, after the Soviet Union collapsed, Russia, which was a big chunk of it, went through a secondary collapse of its own, where the government became more or less non-functional. Tax receipts dwindled to nothing. There was no tax code. Tax was levied by decree. The structure of taxation was such that any business that actually paid taxes would bankrupt itself in the process. So tax fraud was rampant as well, which didn't help matters. And then because the government was not functioning, but it was a developed economy that depended on long-distance trade, there was just a ridiculous amount of mafia involvement that made up for the absence of any kind of a regulatory apparatus. Because any time you have a market but no enforcement and regulatory mechanisms, it automatically becomes a criminal market. So this went on through the 90s, and that wave crested around 95, 96. Then there was a government default because the government tried to finance itself by printing obligations, kind of like the way the Federal Reserve is doing now, except that they started from a position of greater weakness. But I think you know, basically the course of these things is the same. Eventually, they lose control over the interest rates, and the interest rates start doubling. And then after that, it's then it's like the show is over at that point. But that was the worst of it. And then the turnaround point was really when Putin got into office for his first term and declared that there would be such a thing as dictatorship of the law. He, strangely enough, absorbed a lot of these mafia regulatory functions into the various government ministries that he controlled. And it turned out that these ministries could very favorably compete with the mafia people and actually undercut them and put them out of business. So the protection rackets were first legalized, and then they became part of the government. And so after that, it's been just continuous improvement, very, very steady and rather swift improvement in the state of affairs, so that now, for instance, you have, teenage girls hitchhiking through Moscow, unattended, and nobody thinks about it, and that's fine, and they even, like, carry iPads on them, and nobody thinks that they're going to get robbed, because they don't, because it's suddenly become a very law-abiding and relatively safe place. So the turnaround has been very, very profound. Now, in the United States, the trend is unmistakably in the opposite direction. Basically, we're going into this kind of like post-Soviet state where people are sort of still being fed, but less and less. You know, they're going to start cutting food stamps soon, I hear, which is probably the last line, you know, that what stands between a lot of people and malnutrition at this point. So that's really, you know, cutting to the quick for a lot of people. A lot of people who are who are depending on Social Security for basically keeping them from becoming destitute in their old age are probably not going to get any meaningful amount of money by the time comes. And again, in Russia, it's the opposite trend there. Old age pensions are actually becoming something that you can live on. It used to be a joke. You would receive enough money to buy a loaf of bread once a month. But now they keep increasing them, and they even passed legislation so that Russians who emigrated to the United States but now are facing destitution in their old age because here there's no retirement. Well, they can go back to Russia and start getting retirement payments from the Russian government. Strange as that seems, but I think a lot of Russian emigres will flee back to Mother Russia when the time comes.
What about the health of the people and the longevity, the nutrition or malnutrition?
Well, there's just a really huge overhang. People did not live healthy lives, and so they're not healthy in their old age, and their life expectancy is poor. There are a lot of bad habits. The diet hasn't been particularly good over the years. And I think it'll take a few generations to wash through the system. So right now we still have a lot of people who are not particularly elderly, but they're already quite sick in Russia. But the trend is in the other direction. So the younger the people are, the healthier they are, the better they look, the more physically fit they are. And they went from a country where you ate salt fish to a country where there's a sushi place on every corner. And so the health of the people improves along with it. Right now in St. Petersburg and Moscow, there are just lots and lots of places where you can get very healthy food. Unlike the United States, where in a lot of places you just you're forced to choose between one kind of bad food and another kind of bad food, really. So I think the health of the Russian population will improve, and in the United States, the projection is that by 2020, 50% of Americans will have diabetes because of the bad
diet.
That's
correct. Well, these are not just because we've ghettoized the food. It's because we have chosen the wrong food. We've tried to give ourselves an excuse that it's poor people, uneducated people. It's not true. Every person I've ever interviewed that I've counseled who has been sick was fully aware that what they were doing was wrong. It's just that they didn't want to change their habits. I think we have to stop apologizing. The left can't do that. The left is forever embedded with guilt that no matter what mistake you make, it's never your fault. Never be responsible. Someone else caused this. It's a perpetual victimization state, and it's just not the reality. Not for those of us who actually have a living, actually help people, who are actually engaged in a constructive way in finding solutions. Then you can't be in denial, and you can't be dealing with false solutions. You have to ask, did you know eating this was could cause harm? Yeah. Why'd you do it? Well, because I like the way it tastes. It's, you know, I like the crunchy, salty. I like the sweet, soft. It wasn't because they were littered on it. And yet if you say, well, people didn't know. People didn't know. People didn't know smoking was bad. People didn't know drinking alcohol was bad. Really? No. I don't think so. Now, let's get to what really bothers me most about Russia. It's lack of freedom to represent anything that could be a meaningful representation of the people's will. The inability to have any reformists come forward and have any chance of staying out of jail. It seems like Putin and the other people like him know that no matter what happens, they have so much control over everything that nothing in Russia happens unless they want it to happen. So anyone who wants to do something that represents a true freedom of the people, those people don't have a chance. They end up in harassed, beaten, jailed, tortured. That's the Russia that I'm aware of. And I have a lot of friends who are Russians and some who are very high placed. And that, aside from everything else, because everything else can still exist along with a completely corrupt system. And to give you an example of that, look at Georgetown. Look at Washington, D.C. Yes, there's some poverty pockets, absolutely. But there are some of the wealthiest individuals and the highest end real estate. But the laws by which they live and the power grid that they're connected to support them as long as they don't challenge the authority. A lot of people live off Putin and his sycophants, but the moment they get challenged that or want to change it, Putin responds, and the whole system responds around Putin. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, it's a really nasty turn of events that, you know, in Russia, the way you maintain your political popularity with the vast majority of the population is by going out and bashing the heads of a few young, well-dressed cosmopolitan people who are subject to Western corrupting influences. Because you see, Russia went through an episode that brought it to the brink of oblivion as a country. And that was supervised and inspired by American neocons, international consultants, economists, businessmen, politicians. It was all influenced from the outside. Yeltsin was an acceptable leader because he was weak, you see, and because he could be manipulated by Western interests. He was not really a sovereign leader. And that almost destroyed the country. And people understand that. And so what they want is not just somebody who is independent, who can basically tell Washington where to stick it, but somebody who actually shows it. Somebody who can, with absolute impunity, take all of these Western efforts to, quote-unquote, democratize Russia based on these democratic principles that we see applied so well in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, and to basically bash the hell out of it. Not just not allow it, but actually show just how much people hate that. And so this is something that Westerners miss, is that every time, you know, somebody breaks up one of those demonstrations where the creative elite of Moscow, having read a bunch of Western populations and tweeted each other and Facebooked each other half to death, they go out and they protest this and that, you know, hoping to get somewhere, get some attention from the West doing it, because, you know, they're not going to get a lot of attention from their own people for doing this sort of thing. And they get bloodied and they get arrested, etc., and get humiliated and so on. Puja's popularity goes up. This is something that people here don't understand, is that this is not just, you know, regrettable, but it's also just a hard-nosed winning strategy.
Define Putin. Is he a modern-day Mussolini? Define who he really is as a person. We've seen him with his shirt off. We've seen him posing. We've seen his ruthlessness. We know where he came from as one of the heads of the KGB. We've seen what he does to stay in power. But we don't know really anything about him beyond what we have been told in the American media. Tell us more about your impression of Putin.
He's a very, very competent manager. He is soft-spoken, but he's very well-spoken. He's extremely intelligent. He's fantastically disciplined and has tremendous willpower and self-control. He is definitely a control freak. You know, he's a martial artist. He's hard on himself, and so he is actually an attractive figure to a lot of Russians, believe it or not. And some of them see him as a good leader for the country at this point in time, and a lot of people, even ones who don't like him at all, would agree that there really is no alternative at this point, that he is it. Now, of course, power corrupts, and, you know, he's surrounded by layers and layers of bureaucracy that he manages fairly well, I would say. You know, I've seen quite a few improvements in terms of how the apparatus in Russia functions, having had direct dealings with it. You know, the bureaucracy is still as fearsome as ever, but navigating it has become a little bit easier, and they're acting a little bit more professionally. And the thing that surprised me the most is all of these officials that I dealt with, all of them were polite. Every single one of them. I did not get insulted once, except when I went to the American consulate in St. Petersburg. That was the only place where people were rude to me. But all of these government offices, nobody swears, nobody curses, everybody's polite, everybody's professional, and things generally operate not so badly at all. And so this is something that he has managed to pull off, which is quite a feat, I think. So, you know, people tend to be down on Putin, but I think that what they hate about him the most is that he's competent. They really hate the fact that he does a good job.
Well, if nothing else about Putin, you can say that when he does something, he doesn't really care what the rest of the world thinks, and he just does it. And that's why it's rather interesting to see Obama, you know, scolding him for not turning over Snowden when the United States has refused to turn over known and convicted in absentia criminals, terrorists, people that have blown up airplanes, people that have engaged in genocide against indigenous cultures in Honduras and Guatemala and Chile. And they're living with impunity in the United States because they were part of the CIA and our foreign policy expedition in getting a favored position in those countries. We don't turn any of those people over, and yet here, you know, we're saying, oh, Putin this, Putin that. Putin's looking at us saying, what are you, clowns? But Putin couldn't do any of this if he didn't have oil. And one of the things that Russia is doing that we never talk about, you never hear in the United States, is that right now Russia has the fifth largest economy in the world. I mean, that's tremendous when you consider that the United States is just barely holding on to number one, China's number two, Japan's number three, the European Union's number four, and Russia's number five. Russia's going to overtake the European Union, China's going to overtake the United States, and Japan's going to fall way the hell back in the next 2 years. And then you're going to see a realignment because Russia has something everyone needs, and they have more of it than anyone else in the world. They have more oil than Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Kuwait combined. They have more natural gas. They have more minerals. China needs minerals. China's making deals, you know, at $20 a barrel for oil with Russia. And so that brings up this area. When you look at Russia's relationship with the other BRIC countries, Brazil, India, China, and South Africa, challenging America's power over global trade rules, and you look at Obama pushing for the ratification of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the North Atlantic Trade Treaty as a direct threat to Russia, and in your earlier writings, you focused upon the dire economic situation in the Soviet Union that led to its collapse, and you noted parallels in the United States, American emphasis on military expenditures, which is 53 cents out of every dollar, goes to our utterly, completely corrupt military-industrial complex. Total waste. They're always building up, expanding, and invasively positioning themselves within countries or in our own lives, militarization of our schools, the police forces, military overreach. And yet, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the media gave the impression of an emergency elitist class taking over the nation and doing little to nothing for improving Russia's social welfare and economic status. You've given us a different point of view on that. It was thought to be a criminal free-for-all, when in fact you saying it was more of a capitalist free-for-all dream. The ones with the most power would economically win as well. Nevertheless, Russia's democracy rose out of a communist system, which did have socialist protections for average citizens. And those, are you're saying, are gone now, except for pregnancy and a few other areas. But at least the standard of living is increasing. And all that's because of oil. At $100 a barrel going up, Russia is on a trajectory to probably be the third largest economy in the world in the next 5 years. And at least that's the way it's looking. So when you look at Russia and China, the relationship they have, Russia, China, and Iran, Russia, China, and countries in Africa, especially the Chinese. You talk about being smart and thinking long term. They went in there and they started working with communities. They built hospitals. They built clinics. They built schools. They created relationships with local governments. But they got the land. They had their farms. They had their resources. We go in and we build military bases and we corrupt the leaders and anyone else, well, too bad for them. So what you have is you have America becoming a rogue nation, an egotistically power-driven, nationalistic country, priding itself with mythic grandiosity of possessing a mandate as the single global power. And yet, that's an illusion. Except for the people who watch Fox and listen to Rush Limbaugh because they believe that's true. So in our final moments here, give us a perspective of what you see happening with the rest of the world, how it's going forward, and we're being left behind. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think that Russia, of all the countries in the world, is probably the best positioned to survive well into the 21st century. We're looking at lots of different kinds of upheaval that are going on, lots of different types of problems, including floods of people migrating from place to place for environmental reasons as well as economic reasons. A lot of countries will get disrupted and destroyed in the process, but I think Russia is actually in a pretty good position. And it's not just oil and natural gas. Russia is rich in just about every kind of resource imaginable. And so plus it's far enough north that even as many parts of the planet become too parched and too hot for anything useful to happen, Russia will still have a reasonably temperate climate. If anything, the agriculture in Russia will improve. And so it's in a unique situation with just two other countries, really, which is Canada and Argentina, as far as the ability to grow food well into the 21st century. So I think that, you know, Russia is a country with great promise, and I think that people deserve to look at it for what it is as opposed to what it means to the United States. Just leave the United States out of it. Russians don't think the United States is particularly relevant. They were interested in it for a while, and some Russians still think about sending their children to American universities or maybe buying a condo in Miami, things like that. That's still kind of popular. But, you know, the blush is off the rose as far as Russians looking at the United States. It's just not that interesting to them anymore. And they're not really interested in all of this posturing and all of this pseudo-Cold War drumbeat. None of that really means a lot to them. They don't want to fight America. They just want to buy a big chunk of it.
Final comment from you, if you would, please. We're building up our military and spending 53 cents out of every dollar on the military-industrial complex. We're not spending money on our infrastructure, our roads, our highway, the bridges, the tunnels, our water purification. We're not doing anything to stop the desertification of our West, the drought in our states. 16 states are in permanent drought. We're not doing anything to inform, let alone protect, the people living at the shoreline in Miami or New York or Washington, D.C. We're not doing anything to change the corruption of our political system, of how people are put into office by special interest groups and monies. We're not addressing the health care of Americans. We're not addressing any of the serious issues. What do you see happening to the United States because of what we're doing at this moment?
Well, this military is very, very expensive, but it's also very, very incompetent. You have to keep in mind that they haven't won a single, prevailed in a single conflict, except for the invasion of Grenada under Reagan, and maybe the invasion of Panama under George Bush Sr., when Noriega got arrested, but the rest of them, you know, not Somalia, not Iraq is a disaster. Afghanistan is going to remain a disaster. Korea was fought to a stalemate. Vietnam was basically, a defeat. This military cannot win. All it can do is spend money, and so one of the things that might actually bring some reality into it is, at some point, there might be a little bit of a skirmish with an actual military power, not a tiny country, but like a major player, which will result in a humiliating defeat. And that will be just a complete turnaround. That will basically change the mindset in a dramatic way. So that might actually put a halt to this trend of you know, the country eating itself from the inside by spending all of its money on the military. But short of that, I think it's kind of like this zombified system that will continue functioning until it's starved of money and falls apart because of that. That is the only other thing that could stop it, I think.
I see both countries failed and flawed and corrupt. I do not believe that Russia is any less corrupt at every level than the United States. When you compare Russia's life expectancy, it's one of the worst in the world. Of the developed nations, of the 36 top OECD countries, it's dead last. But also I see that it's ranked way above the United States in employment, job security, the unemployment, educational attainment. It's really high. And social inequality based upon income level. Russia is very, very good. The United States is 27th. And so I'm looking at all these things, and I'm comparing one country to the other. But I see that it has to be, that the change has to come from the progressives within both countries, a younger generation seeing that through its education and its political power and its willingness to make some changes, you know, it has to at some point start to get ahead of the curve, both in Russia and the United States. Otherwise, just having a country that is prosperous because of its resources and because of the iron hand of its leadership doesn't mean that it will sustain itself. The moment you have a personality cult like Putin who's out of power, you create a vacuum. And very quickly, all this can turn around. And we've seen this happen in other countries. And that is also true in the United States. But in the United States, less so. It really doesn't matter who's president of the United States, because the people that select you before they elect you make sure that their interests are always taken care of first. Even if it means when taking care of their interests first, it means that ultimately there'll be a blowback. They could care less because they control the police, they control the military, they control the judicial. So they live in these protective little zones, and I believe that'll become all the more common, not only in the United States, but in some other countries. If you're very rich, very connected, you don't have to worry. You'll be protected. Everyone else, you'll live in a ghetto, and you'll have to survive as best you can in that environment. And I believe that the United States, just the average American, just hasn't understood that yet. Dmitry, thank you very much for coming on and sharing some very profound insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Dmitry Orlov, O-R-L-O-V, the author of The Five Stages of Collapse. And another one, The Reinventing Collapse. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.